Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey, everyone. Welcome in to the weekend edition of the KE Report. Corey and Shad here, your hosts on the weekend edition, also your host throughout the week on our website, kereport.com, and podcast, The KE Report. On this weekend show, we're going to start off focusing a bit more on the resource sector, as we are going to chat with Matt Geiger, managing partner at MJG Capital. Then on the back end, we're switching our focus again over to the energy sector. So broadly, focus on resources, but initially focus a bit more on the mining market and then over to energy. Now, Matt, we always enjoy having you on because you provide kind of that outside perspective on the market. Being a fund manager, you are looking for good investment opportunities, but you're also not looking for short-term trades. You're looking for what we have learned, more kind of stable investments. You want to ride along with companies that are doing the right work and that are increasing their overall value for shareholders. You're about to head off to the PDAC this week in Toronto. It's, I believe, the largest mining conference in the world, at least in North America. Let's talk about the junior mining market then, because that's where you focus a lot within your fund. And quite frankly, the junior mining market, for as good as, let's say, the underlying commodities have done, or as stable as they have been price-wise, the juniors, they continue to get hit. You can pull up a wide range of charts on juniors, and they're just not looking that good. We continue to hear comments from junior companies still complaining about their share price. Matt, please give us your general assessment of the current state of the junior mining market right now.
It's good to be back on the program here, Corey. Thanks for having me. I'll push back against that a little bit. I mean, I do think there is a clear case of the haves and the have-nots in the sector. And there are a lot of companies trying to come to market now. And there's not financing dollars sloshing around for your average or, you know, sub-average junior. There certainly are for the highest quality stories and the highest quality management teams. But it's definitely a bit of a bifurcated field. But I would say the TSXV is up 10% through the first 60 days of the year. I mean, what more else could investors in this space want? I mean, I would say it's been a strong start to the year. Yes, things have tailed off a little bit since late January, but all things equal, I would say it's been a strong start to the junior year. And you know, we've seen that occur in the MJG portfolio as well. You know, our latest featured investment is one example. Bravo Mining is up 60% year to date. So there are stories out there that are outperforming and have moved quite a bit in these first 60 days. You know, the real question from my perspective is whether this year will follow that playbook that we know all too well, which is, you know, New Year's optimism, starting off the year strong, starting to fade in the spring, you know, followed by a brutal summer and fall. And then a little bit of a bounce towards the end of the year after early tax loss selling takes place. You know, for 2022, for instance, even though that was an exceptional year with the Russia-Ukraine conflict and you know, a whole host of other geopolitical matters, it followed largely that same playbook. So the pattern we saw last year was pretty familiar to us junior investors. Again, the strong start in the year, and in the case of 2022, the rally through April, then misery really from May through October. And then, you know, juniors gaining strength in October, November, and December through the end of the year. So my base assumption is that this same pattern will repeat this year. So, I mean, I think that junior investors would be well advised to keep a slug of cash handy in the case that this does occur, to focus on names where the specific investor has that sufficient level of conviction to hold said position for a minimum of, say, 3 years. So really only sticking with positions that you're comfortable holding longer term. And then I also think this market environment should favor names that have defined downside, which is a bit of a foreign subject for most of your juniors, where they have small cash balances that are getting lower by the day relative to their market capitalizations. That said, there are some names out there, and two names that come to mind within the MJG portfolio. I think we've discussed both of them on previous KER calls, would be Almedex Minerals and Knorland, where in their cases, you know, cash and marketable securities are covering 60 to 80% of their current market capitalizations. So they don't have to fall all too much before they're trading at quote unquote liquidation value. So I like opportunities in this space when you have nice defined downside, just in case this, you know, optimism in which we started the year peters out, as we often see. That said, just to conclude, there are, of course, years, and 2016 comes to mind, where things start off very hot and they continue to stay hot through the course of the year. So in 2016, we saw junior markets rip really nonstop from January through August, September timeframe before things cooled off, you know, towards the end of the year. So I'm certainly not ruling out that scenario either. And I would love to see it personally, because even though we do have some cash, we're still quite deployed and we would catch such a move, you know, a pretty flush. But from my experience investing in this industry, it's usually best to expect the worst and to plan accordingly for that. And if things work out better than expected, then you can be surprised to the upside. I think that's the way to play it.
Yeah, Matt, you said it. It's best to expect the worst. And that typical seasonality, we'll see if we get the proverbial PDAC curse. It may have come early this year, though, leading up to the event. But then there's those summer doldrums you outlined, sometimes a little spring fling in there. And then we have the fall rally that typically comes in towards the end of the year. And we did see that play out in 2022. I don't think anybody on the call or listening to this interview would mind a 2016 run, though, where we really got to see some excitement in the sector. But just circling back to something that Corey said in the intro about a lot of the companies complaining about their share price, I'd love to get your thoughts on this, because it seems like a lot of these companies maybe blame the sentiment, or they blame the sector or retail investors or institutions, but they rarely blame themselves, as is so true in life. And a lot of times it's their options that they're paying themselves, diluting the shares, or the warrant structure creating a price overhang, or the fact that they haven't put out any news in months, or the fact that when they get the slightest bump, they go out and raise capital and dilute people down again, and it takes the wind out of everybody's sails. So how do you separate the companies, if you're going to hold them for a couple of years, that you feel are doing a good job to build value versus the ones that are really their own worst enemies?
Yeah, I think you touched on a lot of good points there, Shad. And the sector that we are in are rife with teams that are either inexperienced or improperly incentivized. And then there are, of course, your fair share of crooks out there as well. And I mean, I'll say that straight up. Investors should be very, very cautious with who they're investing in. There's over 2,000 juniors, you know, spread between North America and Australia. And everybody approaching the space needs to come in with the mindset that maybe a few hundred of them are potentially investable. So as an investor, one of the greatest strengths you can have is actually weeding out these teams early in the due diligence process, so you can really hone in your search onto higher quality names. Yeah, I mean, to your point, the one point that you touched on that stood out to me is this hamster wheel that most of these juniors find themselves on. Once you get into the mode of putting out your big news flow and then being almost out on cash, you find yourself in a very tricky situation. So many juniors will, you know, do a drill program. They'll be coming out with results. Sometimes those results are even good to quite good. If they're fantastic, then there can be aberrations in the share price. But unless you put out world-class intercepts, in market conditions such as these, if investors know that you're going to need to finance before you do any proper work, they're just not going to buy the common share straight up. So I think you see a lot of juniors in this similar position where they've actually maybe put out pretty good results, and their projects do justify more expenditures and do deserve to see that next, you know, quote unquote, unanswered question answered. That said, when there's not a huge amount of money rushing into juniors and investors are behaving rationally and patiently, you know, you're not going to see that strong buying on the open market if there's any sense from investors that said company is going to have to come back to market and finance. So as a junior, and it's easier said than done, but if you can get to that stage where you have enough cash to accomplish multiple catalysts, then you're in a completely different basket, because you can say with a straight face to the market, yes, we put out good results, but we have enough cash to drill another 6,000 meters, or we have enough cash to last through the end of the year, and by then we'll have a sense of whether we get our mine permit on time. So really focusing on names that are well capitalized, I mean, that's in market conditions such as these, that's half of the battle right there.
So, Matt, as you said, it is kind of a bifurcated market for the juniors. There are a select few that are doing well, that have already raised a bunch of money just even in the last few months. And then there's a lot that kind of continue to struggle, or at least stuck in that never-ending treadmill that they can get on. Do you then just focus on what the market is telling you in terms of which stocks are better because they are separating themselves from the rest of the pack?
No, that's an interesting question. I mean, yeah, in some ways it can be self-selective, but I try not to rely on the market to inform my opinions. I want to have my own opinions with my own solid basis. And if they're confirmed by the market, then that's good. Sometimes you have an opinion about something and the market agrees with you and agrees with you a little bit too much. And in that case, you can take profits. So I think it's important for investors to stand on their own two feet and not rely too much on the market to tell them which name to go to. Because then in that case, you'd ultimately become a momentum trader to some degree. And that's not the game that we play. When I look at an investment, I try to dumb it down to really just two components. How much is this company worth? And it can be worth either, you know, from a fair value perspective or an expected value perspective, depending on whether it's a, you know, a proper investment or more of a binary speculation. And then you say, what is it worth? And then what is it priced for? And if there's a massive divergence between those two figures, then there's one of two possibilities. One is that there's something you're missing and there should be that divergence. And actually, that's quite often the case. So you should be skeptical if you see a massive divergence between what you think something is valued and what it's priced at. And you should do further due diligence to see what you're missing. But if you turned over every stone that you can and you still don't see the rationale for that disconnect, that's when I get excited as an investor. So it is true value investing mindset. And really, whatever the market's telling you is insignificant if you dumb it down to that level.
Some good thoughts there, Matt, for people to consider. And really, it comes down to people doing solid due diligence on companies and teams in advance. But there are times where a certain area, like a jurisdiction or area play, gets a buzz. And there are times where certain minerals or metals get a buzz, like we've seen lately with lithium and previously in uranium and other sectors. But there also is sometimes where a certain type of deposit gets a buzz around it. And right now, carbon replacement deposits, the CRDs, are getting a lot of traction anywhere people can find them, but in particularly in Nevada. And Matt, the last time you were on, we were talking about I-80 and Ridgeline and Paycor. And you had mentioned that Paycor was right near the Ruby Hill deposit that I-80 has been exploring. And we saw news come out on February 27th where I-80 is now going to acquire Paycor, just showing the intense focus companies have and investors have on these CRD deposits, especially in Nevada. I'd love you to unpack that deal more. Someone that's pretty familiar with it. And I should disclose, I am a shareholder of I-80, so I was pretty excited to see the deal go through myself.
Yeah, that's definitely been the latest shoe to drop in kind of this nascent CRD in Nevada trend that we're seeing. I mean, just a few years ago, it'd be hard pressed to find a single junior that was, you know, advertising that they're looking for CRDs in Nevada. I think that's going to change. And I think the success of I-80's exploration programs at Ruby Hill have justified that. Ruby Hill is a fantastic discovery. I don't know if I would quite call it world-class, but I mean, it has the potential to be. Those are some absolutely wicked intercepts. And I'm quite confident it will become a mine later this decade. I think that the fact that it's a brownfield site is also quite helpful. There's the Archimedes pit, you know, right nearby the CRD mineralization that they're drilling. So I've already seen enough that I think this will make it into production. It's just a question of how big it is at this point. As you mentioned, Paycor is right next door with their FAD property, just to the south of Ruby Hill and on trend or seemingly on trend with the CRD mineralization. You know, Paycor themselves confirmed that it was on trend by drilling some pretty nice intercepts themselves. Maybe not quite up to the Ruby Hill standards, but close. So I think this tie-up makes a lot of sense from the I-80 perspective. This is definitely a strategic acquisition. Plenty of companies to justify M&A, you know, use the buzzword synergies. Here, I think you can actually say that is the case. So I'm excited to see that. I mean, it's definitely indirect positive news to the, you know, handful of juniors, you know, now that Paycor's out of the picture, the handful of other juniors that are focused on CRDs in Nevada, you know, two to come to mind that are just in the Eureka district, you know, right nearby Paycor and of course I-80 are Timberline and Golden Lake. So they're earlier stage, you know, micro cap companies, but they're focused on CRDs, you know, in the same district that we've seen this M&A activity. You know, looking further afield in Nevada, there is, of course, Ridgeline, which you brought up, and a Peter McGaugh-backed company called Reyna Silver that are active on CRD deposits elsewhere in Nevada. I am biased on Ridgeline, as we do own shares, and I'm very confident in the team there and what they're working on. But personally, I like how Ridgeline really has two kicks at the CRD can, so to speak. One, of course, is at their Salina project, where they'll be coming out with additional drill results here pretty shortly, I'd imagine. And that's the project that the market's following most closely. But then also a bit under the radar in the past 6 weeks or so, they announced that they'd staked a project called Big Blue, which is actually contiguous to Reyna Silver's Medicine Springs project. And Big Blue has both CRD and skarn and potentially porphyry potential. But success at Reyna Silver would be good news for Ridgeline due to its Big Blue project. And conversely, success at Big Blue, even though I don't think Ridgeline is going to be drilling that in the you know near future, would be good for Reyna Silver. So Ridgeline itself has its feet in a couple buckets there, which I find interesting. Just quickly for folks that are non-geologically inclined, and the geologists listening to this will roll their eyes, but I think it'd be helpful to just revisit these systems and how they sometimes conform. So CRDs are come from a porphyritic intrusion at depth. So obviously if a porphyry comes to surface, there's not going to be associated mineralization with it. But oftentimes you'll see a porphyry at depth, you'll see a skarn mineralization that's proximal to said porphyry. Then it can transition into its CRD zone or the CRD horizon. And then if the system's fully intact, you'll go all the way to surface and you can see epithermal, you know, or oxidized gold and silver mineralization at surface. And so it's interesting, you know, these aren't standalone deposits. They're associated with porphyries. And interestingly for CRDs, it doesn't need to be an economic porphyry for one reason or another, you know, for there to be a world-class CRD deposit. One example would be Taylor down in Arizona, currently or formerly Arizona Mining, now in the hands of South 32. There is a porphyry there, just not of particular interest. So they're focusing more on the skarn and the CRD mineralization. So for those that have been following the Ridgeline story, just to double back, that kind of helps put some context on why in the valley we're seeing Freeport in a joint venture earning into a deep lying porphyry target. And then Ridgeline has the part of the system that's closer to surface or higher up in the system, so to speak. That's why they're seeing CRD potential and then also seeing their gold and silver at surface. So I thought that'd be helpful context for some of the folks listening in that are trying to wrap their heads around CRD deposits and how they fit in geologically.
Yeah, thanks for going there, Matt. But let's also take it a step further. Because there is such a mix of metals here, gold, silver, lead, zinc, how do you go about analyzing these sort of just even initial drill results? Because you can get higher grades of one metal over the other. It can vary within the deposit. How do you analyze the value of certain holes?
Ultimately, I think it comes down to rock value in this industry. And folks get too carried away by whether, you know, it's a gold intercept or whether it's a zinc intercept, you know, or whether it's a lithium intercept. I mean, at the end of the day, it comes down to rock value. How valuable is this rock at current spot prices? So that's how I think about it generally. Now, if you do have a polymetallic deposit, you do have to be careful because there are going to be recovery challenges. So I'm generally okay with, at least for CRD systems, for companies to use silver equivalent, at least assuming that they're focused on the primary metals, zinc, lead, you know, silver, gold, maybe copper if it's thrown in there. I'm okay with that as long as there aren't any, you know, niche metals that are thrown in there that are spiking the values. But when investors look at that figure, they have to assume that there's going to be varying recoveries for the different metals that are included in that silver equivalent or that zinc equivalent number and discount accordingly. So keep that in mind. And that makes it that much more important for the bar to be exceeded with drill results. So in some cases, and I would say Ruby Hill is one of them, the grades are so high in these intercepts, and the widths are quite amenable to underground mining, that really, regardless of metallurgy, and again, maybe I'm stepping out on a branch there, metallurgy is a key, it will be a key risk, as it is with any polymetallic deposit. But the grades we're seeing there are so obscene that I think there's a healthy cushion that's built in as we get more clarity on the recoveries for each of the specific metals.
Matt, I'll step out on that branch with you and just suggest that when we talk to companies, when we interview them, a lot of them make a big deal about metallurgy because it is important. It's what majors are looking at if they want to take over a project. It's what developers need to consider if they want to take it to production themselves. And often they have to produce different concentrates, or sometimes there's penalty metals in there, to your point, that can be detractors when they go to the smelter penalties. And so there's a lot that goes into it. But a question I have about polymetallic deposits, because this happens a lot when you look at copper companies. This happens a lot when you look at nickel companies, PGM companies, because a lot of them are really polymetallic by nature. Even most silver deposits that people claim are silver companies are really lead and zinc companies parading around with some silver in there. So when there's these multi-intercept or multi-metal intercepts, a lot of investors can't react to it the same way they can to a really clear gold intercept or a really clear silver intercept. So how do you think that the market has evolved over time? Because it seems like these CRD deposits are getting a reaction. We saw the reaction to Ridgeline. We saw the reaction in I-80. We saw the reaction to this recent deal with Paycor. It seems like people are starting to get that it's all about the metal in the ground. Do you think that investors, maybe because of the internet or just learning more about the sector, have become more sophisticated?
I think to some degree. I mean, I think tough market conditions, and we've actually, it's not been too bad over the past few years, but over the past decade, this has not been a booming time for the mining industry. I think that's fair to say. It's self-selecting for more sophisticated investors. So, you know, as I believe we're in a longer-term commodity bull market here, I think it's going to be an excellent decade. As this decade increases, I think the level of sophistication will decrease across the investor base. So I think it's some of that. I think it's also proof of concept. I mean, Arizona Mining is the kind of the tried and true example right now. When we saw close to a 2 billion Canadian takeout there. And so we know now, you know, as of 2018, where I believe that deal went through, we know now that the world's largest, you know, diversified miners are interested in these, in this style of deposit, including assuming that it has enough scale. But in the case of Arizona Mining, CRDs do have enough scale. You know, Peter McGaugh's success with Mag Silver down at Juanicipio is another example. So I think there are some pretty recent use cases here where we have a sense that if you find an excellent CRD, there is a market amongst it, you know, for multi-billion dollar companies. So yeah, combination of those proof points and greater sophistication of an investment base. Because as you say, when the markets get really goofy, investors just like to chase specific metals. And that's just really not the way to go about investing in this space, but it always happens. So when we're not in those goofy phases of the market, folks are more willing to sit back and say, well, yeah, maybe I like gold over copper, or maybe I like copper over gold. But, you know, if there's an excellent new discovery of said metal and it looks like it's going to be economic and I like the management team and I think this project can be permitted, and oh, it's trading at 40% of the valuation that I think is fair for this stage, I don't care if it's gold or copper focused. I think this is a mine that's going to make money, assuming reasonable metal prices, and I'm going to invest in it. So I think that's the way to approach it. I think in, you know, less euphoric times, that's the way that a lot of my fellow investors also think about things.
Yeah, fair enough. That's, I think, more of the level-headed way to look at it. But you know what? People do get sucked into the hotter metals. And quite frankly, you can actually get valuations extended to the upside, which investors, that's what they're looking for. Not to fly in the face of your last comment regarding some of the other metals or hotter metals that come and go, you did send us a note that you had some thoughts on the vanadium market. There's been some interesting developments over the last few months. Matt, take us through, what has you attracted to vanadium right now?
Yeah, I just figured this could be interesting to your audience. And again, I'll preface it with the caveat I just left us on, where You know, do not chase medals just because they sound exciting. It has to be the right team, the right project. But I think it's important to follow fluctuations that occur amongst different medals to have a sense of where you are in their individual cycles. Vanadium, there's been quite a bit of excitement just over the past 90 days or so. We've seen the pentoxide price pass back above $10 per pound for the first time since, you know, the post-Russia-Ukraine invasion period in, you know, April, I believe, is the last time we were above $10. And vanadium pentoxide has moved 40% off of its lows that we're seeing in September 2022. So we're seeing a pretty healthy move in the actual commodity price that I haven't heard any folks talking about, frankly. Amongst the equities, Largo, which is kind of the blue chip vanadium name, has rallied sharply over the past 90 days. And even though we've seen some softness amongst mining shares over the past few weeks, it's trading right up near its 2023 highs. And we're also seeing the few vanadium listed or vanadium focused juniors, you know, listed in North America, up between 30 to 80% over the same period. So there has been pretty substantial moves in these share prices. Really, the only exception would be Bushveld Minerals, which is a South Africa-based vanadium producer. This is most likely due to concerns surrounding South Africa. But with that said, you know, to Bushveld's defense, last year they did produce a record amount of vanadium from their operations. That said, there's a lot more focus now on the rail, you know, power and social issues that are currently plaguing South Africa. So there's likely some concern about that regarding Bushveld and maybe explains their laggard status. So ultimately, I'd say what is happening? I mean, I think there's a few factors here. First and foremost, and the most important, is the China reopening story. Many folks that are new to this industry and maybe have been pulled in by, you know, lithium investments or battery metal investments may not have been around back in 2017 when the Chinese tightened construction codes, which in effect led to increased vanadium demand as an alloy and Allen agent in these steels. And we're going to see we're already seeing a pretty substantial infrastructure push from China. So I think that's probably, you know, first and foremost why we're seeing this move. You know, as it stands, 92% of vanadium demand is still derived from steel, and vanadium's use as an alloying agent in steel. So you can't overlook that factor. The second potential reason for this move, I've already alluded to. Bushveld is, you know, a major producer of vanadium. In fact, South Africa accounts for roughly 40% primary global vanadium supply. That number drops off quite a bit to closer to 10% if you include secondary vanadium supply or vanadium that's produced as a byproduct or co-product. But it's still a significant player in the vanadium markets, especially vanadium that's produced outside of China and Russia, which are certainly not on the good lists of the Western world at the moment. So concerns about stability in South Africa and whether the power and rail issues that we've all read about are going to affect Bushveld here over the medium term. And then I'd also add, and this probably applies more to the juniors, there is quite a bit of excitement around vanadium redox batteries, spurred really by the Inflation Reduction Act. In fact, in the past 60 days, we've seen no less than 3 flow battery producers announce investments in facilities in the United States. Sumitomo Electric is kind of the heavyweight player there out of Japan. We also have H2 from South Korea and a company called V-Flow Tech out of Singapore. So that's a substantial move from 3 different players in a very shortened period of time here. I think it is fair to attribute this to the Inflation Reduction Act. Interestingly, there's funding available from the IRA for these grid-scale battery storage projects for up to 30% of the initial CapEx of said project to be covered by the Inflation Reduction Act. And for vanadium batteries in particular, there's a huge host of benefits to using them. They're much longer life with minimal to no degradation. They have longer discharge cycles over lithium-ion batteries. They're very easy to recycle or repurpose after use, which differs from some other battery technologies. So there's a ton of pros for vanadium redox. One of the major negatives is that they have a very high upfront capital cost. And if you look at their levelized cost over time, very big percentage of that comes from their upfront cost. So you now have, you know, the U.S. government saying we're going to step in and, you know, in specific cases, cover up to 30% of that initial build cost. I think that could be a boon to this battery technology over the medium to long term. So it's definitely not going to affect, you know, vanadium supply and demand dynamics here for you know, a little while. But I think for the juniors, which are definitely more on the speculative end of the market, perhaps some of the buying that we've seen is due to these developments. And then, of course, we haven't seen any direct investments from either the U.S. or Canadian governments into vanadium-focused mining projects, and we have seen that occur for other critical minerals. So I think it's just a matter of time before we see at least one project, a vanadium-focused project based in North America that's backed. So I think that's another shoe to potentially drop here. Yeah, definitely an interesting metal to at least keep an eye on. And as I mentioned, I think a lot of the folks new to the space probably haven't heard of the word vanadium before, don't know much about the metal. But I remember as a, you know, the narrative can be quite intoxicating. If we think back to the big move in 2017 and 2018, as folks kind of grasp this metal's potential importance in large scale battery storage going forward.
All right, Matt, very interesting. Thank you for covering all of these topics. I hope you have a great time at PDAC this year. We'll touch base after PDAC to get a rundown of your thoughts, a few other people's thoughts who will be at the conference. Hopefully we don't get that PDAC curse. I know a lot of people are thinking about that as we turn the corner and are now in March with PDAC right around the corner. So Matt, thank you again for all your time on this weekend show. Pleasure having you on. I hope you have a great time at the upcoming conference.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout.